Hello and welcome to The Report, a companion podcast to The Report, a movie starring Adam Driver, Annette Bening, and John Hamm. If you are new to this show, I recommend starting with episode one. It will make a lot more sense if you do. And on today's episode, we are going to talk about the fight to get The Report released after it was written. Its release was not always a given. In fact, the leadership at the CIA hoped the Senate torture report would never be released to the public, that it would remain classified. But the biggest champion of the report, Senator Dianne Feinstein, worked to ensure it was released. In the movie, The Report, Feinstein is played by Annette Bening, and I want to play a clip from the film. This is a scene where Feinstein is talking to Daniel Jones about his report.
This is a remarkable document you've created, truly. It will provide an enduring history, whether it comes out or not.
What does that mean, whether it comes out or not? What does she mean? What does that mean?
We've been working on this thing for nearly 5 years.
Yes, and it is still our word against theirs. She's going to need more than that.
Back when this investigation started, there was bipartisan support on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Both Republicans and Democrats agreed the CIA should be investigated and the truth about the torture program should come out.
The fact that the committee became more partisan was discouraging and disappointing and distressing, I think, to all of us.
That's former Colorado Senator Mark Udall of the Senate Intelligence Committee again. Senator Udall was a key figure in the fight to have the report released.
Well, I began my service on the Intelligence Committee believing that everything would be up front, everything would be shared, everything that we did would be done in the spirit of protecting the country. Now, a lot of that was done in classified settings. And when I first started serving on the committee, I felt there was a broad support among the Republicans and Democrats in the committee to continue to make this, to produce this study and then make it public. But the more I sat in some of those classified briefings, the more I read the report, the more I interacted with some of the key leaders at the CIA, including John Brennan, the more I got very disturbed that the goal on the part of the CIA leadership and therefore the Obama administration was to push under the rug as much of this as they possibly could. And there was the classic slow walk strategy that was being employed. And I was not only deeply frustrated, but I was very angry about what was happening. And so I began to look, if you will, in the legislative world, both strategically and tactically, how I could supplement and complement what Senator Feinstein was doing, with the goal of making sure that this report, when it was eventually completed, would be available to the public. And at the core of this was, again, my fierce belief that that what had happened wasn't who we are as a people and as a country. And I couldn't stand by and let it be covered up. It's just not who we are. And it pained me at times because some of the people who were involved in this slow walk, I personally liked. I had admiration for many of them, including President Obama. But I thought this was wrong, what was happening.
One of the ways Senator Udall worked to get the report released was simply to walk across the aisle and try to persuade Republicans that this was the right thing to do, regardless of politics.
I had some private conversations with Republican members of the committee, and I think they felt they had no choice but to go along with some of the leadership on the committee and some of the Republican leadership at large in protesting and doing everything they could to push the report under the rug. As anybody who knows the history of the report knows, it was initially almost a unanimous vote in the committee to conduct the report and the review that backed it up. In a way, one of the other ironies is that as the Obama administration and John Brennan began to stonewall, in many ways like the Bush administration had, that there was a moment there where senators in both parties might have been able to combine forces, because both administrations, a Democratic one and a Republican one, were at fault and were being convinced by the intelligence community that what had happened didn't happen, and that the report would undercut the long-term prospects for the country's security, and on and on. I'll never quite understand why that happened. There were a couple of Republicans, most notably, of course, John McCain and Susan Collins, who supported the report. Olympia Snowe, the Maine senator who had retired, was supportive as well. But there were other senators that I'd hoped, and I don't want to name names, that would be supportive, given their sense of history and the long view that I saw them take in other policy matters. But it became too partisan from some points of view. But and that all became apparent once the election in 14 occurred and the Senate majority was going to change. It was clear that the new Republican chair of the committee and other leading Republicans would submerge the report and do everything they could to make sure it didn't see the light of day.
In the middle of this fight over the report, there was an election. And in November 2014, the Democrats lost their majority in the Senate. The Senate Majority Leader at the time, Harry Reid, handed the gavel over to the new Republican head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell. That meant Republicans now had the power to decide whether or not the public would see the torture report, a report that would detail horrific and inhumane treatment of detainees, all done under the leadership of George W. Bush, a Republican president.
When all the events late in 14 began to unfold and it looked like perhaps the report would never be made public, I made a decision that using the Senate rules and Senate procedures, I was going to attempt to read the report on the floor of the Senate. Now, with as many pages as were involved, that was probably 4 to 5 days by my calculations to read the entire report. I would have needed allies because once you gain the floor in a situation like this, if you relinquish it, you're not going to regain it. And there were a lot of senators that were lined up to prevent me from even being able to gain the floor. And if I had, they were going to continue to look at ways in which to deny me the floor. But I just felt this was so important. It put a lot of pressure, I think, on the White House and others to relent, to allow the report to come forward with minimal redactions, which that was one of the later tactics on the part of the White House and the CIA, was to redact the report in such a way that it was unreadable. Therefore, again, another way of preventing the report from being made public.
As this debate went on, one senator emerged who was uniquely qualified to talk about it. He had credentials that no other member of the Senate had, because he had personally been the victim of torture. He was one of the torture report's biggest supporters, and he was Republican, and he was, of course, John McCain.
I miss John McCain. He was a complicated human being. He was a complicated senator. I didn't always agree with him. We all would joke among ourselves that if you hadn't been blistered verbally by John McCain, you hadn't arrived in the Senate. And I took a lot of my inspiration and my worldview on torture from John and his strong aversion to torture. We know that John was tortured himself in Vietnam. And if you want to read a phenomenal narrative, read John's book where he details those years and years in Hanoi. And his writing will include something like this: "They hung me up by my arms and cut me down 60 hours later. Or the dysentery returned, and 6 weeks later, I felt better." What a courageous and unique American. When I would travel with John, he was always making up for lost time. He'd been held as a prisoner of war and tortured for close to 6 years, and he didn't need to sleep a lot. He catnapped all the time, particularly on these long flights all over the world. And I remember on a couple of occasions we'd landed. And he would turn to me and say, "Mark, how's my hair look?" Because we were just lying. If there was a bed in the plane, we'd lie down. Or if there was a seat that would go back, you'd put the seat back. And he'd say, "How's my hair looking? Can you comb it for me?" The reason John couldn't comb his hair is because he couldn't lift his arms above his shoulders because of all the torture he'd endured. And I then resort to combing his hair with my fingers. He and I had that kind of relationship that was beyond just being two politicians. And so I know that's a very personal story, but I think it gives you a sense of John and just his fierce advocacy without being bitter, really, that torture wasn't acceptable, that it was illegal and immoral, that it put our soldiers and our military personnel at risk, and that it weakened us around the world. And he, of course, personally knew it didn't work, because in those 6 years, John McCain didn't break. And I'm getting goosebumps and almost getting teary-eyed with all that the Vietnamese did to him. And then he went back to Vietnam on a number of occasions and reconciled with former enemies in Vietnam. That's John McCain at his most amazing.
And during the Senate's investigation, John McCain was one of the only consistent Republican allies who worked with Daniel Jones on the investigation.
Senator McCain was involved in this investigation from the beginning to the end, often in a more quiet way, but I would brief Senator McCain and one of his key staffers on what we were finding throughout the investigation. He would, at one point, his nickname for me was Jason Bourne, and he offered to allow some of his interns to start my car. He would joke around like this, but you know, he would use that basically to take the edge off what we were briefing, right? Which was just incredibly outrageous, particularly for someone like John McCain, who has experienced torture and has such a strong vision for what America is and what America should be. But he was massively supportive. He wrote letters. He made phone calls. He, of course, was the key sponsor of the McCain-Feinstein legislation after the report came out, which requires International Committee of the Red Cross access to detainees and prohibits the CIA from using any interrogation techniques that are not in the Army Field Manual of Interrogation. There probably isn't a Senate torture report without Senator John McCain.
We'll be right back after a short break. Okay, we are back. And Daniel, today we know that the Senate is one of the most partisan places in government, right? So it was surprising to hear Senator Udall talk about the bipartisan support for the report. Was that your experience too?
Yeah, every vote related to the Senate report was bipartisan in some way. I mean, the original launch of the investigation was 14 to 1. And then in December of 2012, there was the general approval of this report. That was a 9-6 vote. And at that point, we were sending a report from the committee, a classified report of the committee, to the White House and to the CIA and to other executive branch agencies for them to review and provide comments. We got those comments back, and then there was a vote 11-3 to release a declassified version of that report. Once that declassification vote occurred, then we needed to engage with the White House and the executive branch on redactions. How much of this could we declassify? And we were provided with a report on August 1st of 2004, a report that was so heavily redacted, it buried almost the entire narrative. CIA and the White House would not talk to us at all during that redaction process. We just suddenly received it in August, which, if you're a Washington hand, you know you drop things in August because everybody's gone on vacation. Senate's out on recess. It's the time you drop bad news. And in fact, the President of the United States, President Obama at the time, thought that the Senate was going to release the report as soon as we received it in redacted format. And that's when he gave that famous, "We tortured some folks," speech.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did some things that were contrary to our values. I understand why it happened. I think it's important when we look back to recall how afraid people were after the Twin Towers fell and the Pentagon had been hit and the plane in Pennsylvania had fallen and people did not know whether more attacks were imminent. And there was enormous pressure on our law enforcement and our national security teams to try to deal with this. It's important for us not to feel too sanctimonious in retrospect about the tough job that those folks had.
Senator Feinstein and the other senators on the committee got this report back. The Khalid Sheikh Mohammed component itself was entirely blacked out. And she thought that was fully unacceptable. Other information in the report that was really key to our analysis was redacted and blacked out. And yet, you know, officers, CIA officers who had written books about the very same topic, pushing out misinformation, their books weren't redacted, right? So there's this clear propaganda effort by the agency, and the senators, to their great credit, said, no, this isn't going to work. We need to work with you to declassify more information. Eventually, we've got most of the story on KSM unredacted, and about 7 to 10% of the report now has blackouts. But for the most part, I think you can get through it and read the important parts. But that was a long battle. All the way from August to December, we battled on redactions with the White House.
On December 9th, 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a 525-page redacted executive summary of the report. And one of the most surprising things about this report is its title. Typically, these sorts of government reports have these boring technical titles, but this one is surprisingly frank. The Senate Intelligence Committee Report on Torture. Not Enhanced Interrogation, the official title of the program, but right there, in black and white, torture.
Throughout this process, it was frustrating when commentators or news media would say, you know, these techniques, which some groups call torture or you know, things like that. And it seemed important that we come out of this process with an acknowledgement by most people, by independent people, that what was going on was torture.
Stephen Rickard is the director of foreign policy constituency building at the Open Society Foundation.
And when I read John Rizzo, his memoir, and he was the acting general counsel at the CIA, I noticed that he complained quite bitterly in his book that the Office of Legal Counsel memoranda justifying or providing authorization for the torture program were called universally the torture memos. And he said this is very unfair. They weren't really about torture. You know, he was upset that because he had asked for them that he was therefore the torture guy. But I noticed in his own index of his memoir that if you went to look up Office of Legal Counsel memoranda, it said, see torture memos. And so even in his own memoir, even with his complaining about everybody calling the memos the torture memos, he had no choice. That's what everyone knew them as. And so his own index called them the torture memos. And at that point, it did seem to me important that we begin to use the language that this was the torture report. Now, I don't think that we made that happen, but you know, the fact is that when people saw what was going on, the more they knew about what was going on, people, unless you had a stake in defending the program, your common sense told you that this was torture. And in fact, one time I was sitting in on a focus group in Richmond, Virginia, where a group of 10 people who were, you know, self-described conservative men were being asked their views about torture or about the CIA program. And they were asked as a sort of an initial question, what does the term enhanced interrogation mean to you? And one of them said in a shot, oh, that's just a fancy term for torture. And everyone in the room nodded in agreement. So I don't think we made this happen. I think the facts and getting the facts out is why everyone calls it the torture report, because unless you had a stake in defending the program, when you heard what was going on, you said, like Richard Armitage, Bush administration official who had been waterboarded and was asked, is it torture? And he kind of almost yelled, of course it's torture. I'm ashamed that my country is even having this discussion.
I want to bring Daniel Jones back into this conversation. Dan, you spent years huddled over 6.3 million documents in a basement, and you compiled this remarkably detailed account of the CIA's torture program. It was the largest report in the history of the Senate. And that wasn't even the end of it. You were accused by the CIA of being a criminal. And you were in the middle of this all-out war between the CIA and the Senate and the White House. What was it like for you the day the report was finally released?
You know, when you're doing an investigation like this, you're just so hunkered down and focused on getting it on paper and getting it released. You can't quite pull back to appreciate the moment. But this was a 7-year journey for myself and the staff and the senators involved in this investigation. And getting it out in December 2014 was really just a relief. We had spent so much time and energy on this, and we all believed it was so important. And the next step was educating the public and making sure that this doesn't happen again.
Next time on The Report, we will dive into the story of how the CIA responded to the report once it was released. Amazon Studios' The Report is produced by Topic Studios and Western Sound. Executive producers for Topic Studios are Lital Molad and Lisa Leingang. Special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs. Executive producer for Western Sound is Ben Adair, and the producer is David Weinberg. Hannes Brown composed original music and mixed the show. Daniel Jones is executive producer and host. I'm Kelly McEvers. Thanks for listening.